from Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. You know, that's been true since the very start of State Belief on January 15, 2006. And as we get ready to celebrate 11 years of continuous broadcasting next weekend, let me say a very sincere thank you for that support. As the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, January 7th is the Orthodox Christian Feast of the Nativity. The 8th brings the Christian observance of the baptism of the Lord Jesus. And Thursday marks the start of the Buddhist Mahayana New Year celebration, which continues through January 15th. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, new religious accommodation guidelines in the U.S. Army allow brigade-level commanders to issue permission for servicemen and women to wear beards, turbans, or hijabs for religious reasons. The Atlantic Magazine reports that the action comes in response to litigation and advocacy from Sikh servicemen who wear beards and turbans for religious reasons and who wanted to be able to keep them while actively serving their country. Alt-right internet shrine Breitbart News boss Steve Bannon helped elect Donald Trump and will reap his reward with a plum White House position. But, you know, Breitbart tentacles are now reaching into Europe. A report claiming Muslims celebrated New Year's Eve in Germany by burning down the country's oldest church is completely, demonstrably, unforgivably fake. And it's this kind of propaganda that we all need to be watchful of at home and abroad. And legendary religious scholar and author Houston Smith passed away December 30th at the age of 97. The author of the seminal 1958 book titled The World's Religions, which continues to be widely used almost 60 years later, Professor Smith was an inspiration for me personally, as well as for many others, and the embodiment of interreligious understanding and practice. In 2009, Houston Smith appeared on this program to discuss his just-published memoir, Tales of Wonder, Adventures Chasing the Divine. We've linked to that interview and a transcript from that interview on stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The people got up one last time. The great giant called the family of God got up and voted.
That's right.
And all hell is
I'm
against
a Christian
this
who
presidency.
Wants to preserve his own European heritage as you seek to preserve your own heritage.
2016 was a busy and challenging year for journalists covering religion news in this country and beyond. Which were legitimate voices to amplify? What were significant stories and what were mere distractions? And how do any lessons learned inform that work in the year ahead? On this week's show, I'll pose those questions to Jerome Sokolowski, Editor-in-Chief of Religion News Service.
This professor said, Pastor, don't you want a candidate who embodies the teaching of Jesus and would govern this country according to the principles found in the Sermon on the Mount? I said, heck no. I would run from that candidate as far as possible.
Did you see the list of faith leaders who've committed to taking part at the presidential inauguration on January 20th? Where Barack Obama welcomed a range of faith voices from Bishop Gene Robinson to Pastor Rick Warren, the Trump list is a little bit less diverse. We'll look at that officially sanctioned intersection of religion and government with Interfaith Alliance Rabbi Jack Moline. But first,
There's great confusion. Nobody really knows.
The whole age of computer has made it where nobody knows exactly what's going on.
Nobody really knows what's going on. Now, notice, if you can maintain doubt about a problem's existence, you are under less pressure to solve it. It may not even be a problem. That's obviously how climate change denial works. Call it strategic ignorance.
Hearing those words on a recent episode of the Rachel Maddow Show reminded me of a fascinating guest we featured on this show back in the spring of last year. Dr. Robert Proctor coined the term agnotology to describe the deliberate manufacture of ignorance. As the term fake news has permeated public discourse in recent months, Dr. Proctor has agreed to be back with us on State of Belief Radio to lend his expertise. Robert Proctor, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Great to be here again.
Tell us again what agnotology means.
Well, agnotology is the study of ignorance. It's also the production of ignorance. In other words, philosophers have paid so much attention to knowledge, how we learned this, how we learned that, and what they haven't paid enough attention to is ignorance, how ignorance is created, where it comes from, what feeds it, what nourishes it, and how to overcome it. So what we do in studying agnotology is look at where ignorance comes from, the harm it can do, or even the benefits it can do.
How did you see the concept of agnotology play out in the most recent election?
Well, it was pretty clear, I thought. You had a lot of misinformation, a lot of disinformation circulating. We don't know where it all came from. Some of it seems like it came from Russia. Some of it, came from other sources. We saw the really rise to prominence of commercialized fake news. I mean, there were several stories that were deliberately manufactured, I think, just for profit.
Mm-hmm.
There were some crazy ones. There was the pizza parlor thing where someone, goes into a pizza parlor and blows up stuff just because of, some misinformation that was spread about Hillary Clinton having a sex ring operating in there. So there was some real-world impact of ignorance being spread. And so, we could go on for a long time on that, but, we're in danger. I guess the reality is we're going to inaugurate a president who's probably the most anti-science that we've seen in 100 years. And no one really knows how it's going to play out, but we've got a lot of climate denial going on in there. We've got a lot of corporate over-friendliness going on. So, yeah, ignorance, in a way, won the election for Donald Trump.
You've been sensitive to this for a long time. How early in this campaign season did you see what was going on before other people talked about it?
Well, I, like a lot of people, really couldn't imagine this Carnival Barker casino magnate becoming president.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's been such a campaign to create ignorance for so long in this country, going back to the 80s, 90s. In the early 90s, tobacco industry ganged up with big oil to create the Tea Party. And that's basically an engine for ignorance right there.
Yeah.
And the theory was that, well, we can't come out directly, against cigarette taxes and cigarette regulation and big oil regulation, but if we make a movement that'll attack all regulation and all taxes without singling out cigarettes and oil, we might win. And in a way, that's sort of what happened. Big oil teams up with big tobacco in the early 90s, and they create the Tea Party. There's a great book on this called Poison Tea that's just come out in the past few months. And, they sort of laid the program for the kind of administration we've got. The foundations for a massive movement to create a kind of anti-science denialist victory, I think those seeds have been planted for decades.
You wrote a very fascinating article in the New York Times just a few weeks ago, headlined Climate Change in Trump's Age of Ignorance. That was published after the election, right?
That's right, just shortly after it. Yeah, the idea being that we really are living in the golden age of ignorance. Some of us call it the Endarkenment. It is a dark period from that point of view, again, with lots of uncertainties. But yeah, that was the theme of that, but also it was kind of a mea culpa in the sense that academics have to do more to understand what ordinary people think, the origin of ignorance, you know, why people are willing to follow a guy like Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of what we call distraction research, and a lot of ignorance creation is through distraction, misdirection, a cluttering of intellectual space with, you know, shiny objects that distract us from the truth.
What role is agnotology playing in the wholesale support many conservatives are now giving to the president-elect, pretending that he didn't say something or didn't do something during the campaign to help make the support somehow more palatable?
Yeah, that's so weird to watch. All of the, you know, prim and proper people you'd think would be against, you know, genitalia groping and incendiary comments against women and Latinos, and, you know, and then that whole crew came on board with him. It's kind of like the enemy of the enemy is my friend or something, or a kind of a compromise. I was shocked to see how evangelicals flocked over that. That mm-hmm. was kind of a puzzle to me. But I guess it's, you know, these political forces are so powerful, they railroaded all these other interests, and I hate to say it, but I think race must have played a role mm-hmm. in there as well. So that was disturbing, how that evangelical crowd shifted over to Trump so powerfully, given the vile nature of some of the things he said. I mean, if you think about it, just from a simple ethical point of view, here you've got this guy who's really in the business of beauty pageants and casinos.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the moral, you know, foundation of our society? I don't think so.
How is fake news, that whole phenomenon, connected to what we've been talking about as agnotology?
Well, fake news is something that's new in name but old in practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, lying has gone on as long as there have been humans, and probably a lot older. You know, there's camouflage in the animal world, and the fact that a deer has a white belly, that's basically a lie to tell the puma that it doesn't exist, right? There's camouflage in the animal world. There's deception. This gets more significant after World War II with the rise of massive systematic disinformation and propaganda and the sort of doubt is our product strategies. And remember, there are many ways that news can be fake. There's distracting news, there's confusing news, there's hidden news. You know, there are a lot of ways that news can be faked, and we've given a name to it recently because now we've got whole enterprises mainly connected, I think, to the internet advertising business, where people are circulating deliberately fake stories that seem plausible in the guise of information. And this is fooling people. And I think what's new is how easily the bogus stuff can circulate.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's new is how much money can be made from circulating these fake stories.
Mm-hmm.
But the practice itself goes way back, and I think it's sort of an index of our ignorance that we think it is new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have been lying and trying to fool people and bully people and misdirect them for as long as there have been humans, and now at least we have a name for it. But I think it's just part of a more general, you know, creation of ignorance strategy.
So what does every American, regardless of political affiliation, need to do to become a more responsible consumer of news and information?
Yeah, well, there's several key things. One is always consider the source. Who is saying something? What grounds do they have for saying it? We need to revive the critical intellect, the broader intellect, the challenging intellect. You know, consider the source, consider the context, and above all, consider the implications. You know, if someone is trying to tell you that climate change is a hoax, why are they saying that? What connection is there to big oil? What connection is there to the coal industry? You know, how does that play out? So what is the context? What are the implications? Who benefits? If we can keep asking those questions, I think we can escape some of the dangers of all the propaganda and fake news that's circulating now.
Dr. Robert Proctor is professor of the history of science at Stanford University. Dr. Proctor holds a doctorate from Harvard University and is credited with coming up with the term agnotology to describe the dark art of manufactured ignorance. Robert, I really thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio. And my hunch is that during this year, we're going to have plenty of cause to be back in touch with you again. But thanks for today.
Well, I hope so, Welton. We live in challenging times, and you're doing the Lord's work, so keep up at it.
When award-winning journalist Jerome Sokolowski was named as editor-in-chief at Religion News Service in late 2015, he agreed to be on our show before he had even been assigned an office telephone extension number. We've been very fortunate to have Jerome with us again since then, of course, but I doubt that any of those conversations were as important as the one that we're about to have right now. And the reason for that is a concerted effort on the part of a number of our leaders to undermine news reporting and the press, coupled with a seemingly endless supply of fake news distributed via social media, leaves us and countless Americans not knowing whom to trust. Religion News Service has been providing invaluable nonpartisan, nonsectarian coverage of religion news since 1934. And I am delighted to welcome back to State of Belief Radio Editor-in-Chief Jerome Sokolowski. Jerome, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you again, Wilton, and Happy New Year.
Same to you. You must be watching this undermining of news in this country with particular chagrin. As the head of a major news service, talk about what that feels like.
You know, I've always believed in being straight with our audiences, with our readers. They are the people that we serve. And I think that our credibility rides on how well we report the news that they're interested in. I have seen an upsurge or more interest in what we do since this whole discussion about fake news started. I think a lot of people are coming to value and appreciate what solid journalistic organizations, and I'd like to include our own among them, what we do.
Do you think that this whole discussion of fake news is being overblown?
I think it's very serious. I don't think it's overblown. I recall reading a historical book about the rise of the Third Reich and remembering how the role of this very new technology at the time called radio played a role in people not being able to understand Adolf Hitler's rhetoric and kind of be able to distinguish between truth and rhetorical devices or propaganda. And I almost think that we're in a time like that again, where we have a new kind of medium, which is the internet and social media. And we have to educate ourselves in how to figure out what's true and what's not, how to know what's credible. And just because something is on a website and looks like a news story doesn't mean it is a news story.
How are you and your colleagues responding to this whole trend of delegitimization of news organizations?
I mean, we do what we've always done. We look for stories that we find interesting that say something about religion in America and in the world today, and we report on it in a straight and hard-hitting way. I don't think we need to change anything in the way we report our stories because of this. again, I think the fake news discussion is a good one to have, because people no longer take for granted that there are reporters and news outlets out there trying to cover things honestly and sincerely.
Mm-hmm. I wish you would talk a minute or so about how news consumers can insulate themselves from inaccurate or biased news reporting.
I think it takes a little more work these days, and you have to do a little bit of research. There's certainly the news outlets that are more reliable, New York Times, Washington Post, The Economist. There are many out there that can be trusted, that we all make mistakes. There's no one's claiming that reporting is perfect, but there's, you know, a little bit of research to be done and cross-checking. I would read stories, the same story in different outlets. I think most people who read what's sometimes derogatorily described as mainstream media will be getting as straight as possible a version of you know, the news item they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Jerome, let's look back at 2016. What in your mind were the most significant stories that Religion News Service covered?
Well, I think the most significant collection of stories were the ones related to the presidential election. I imagine that many of us were quite surprised that so many white evangelical Christians voted for Donald Trump, a man who seems to have a view of sex and gender relations that comes out of the movie Animal House, who doesn't seem to live according to evangelical values or Christian values, and certainly has not in the past, and those were not obstacles to him being elected. Mm-hmm. The exit polls had the figure of 81% of white evangelical Christians voting for Donald Trump. To me, that's the biggest story of the year. Other stories I found to be interesting this year are, on the one hand, there were efforts to reconcile Protestant Christianity and Catholicism after, on the 500th anniversary, the beginning of the 500th anniversary year of the Reformation. The Pope went to Sweden to a Lutheran nation to kick off that year. At the same time, if you look at, there's another sectarian conflict that's causing a lot of problems in the world today. I think we've underestimated it in the past for sure, but the division between Shiite Muslims and Sunni Muslims, which seems to have overtaken the conflicts in the Middle East and is even exporting one of the root causes of the exporting violence to Europe. We saw some terrible, terrible terrorist attacks there by people claiming to act out of religious faith. And other stories, we lost some people who either were influenced by religion or had interesting religious views. The Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, Phyllis Schlafly, even Leonard Cohen, the musician, who had a lot of religious themes in his music.
Were there a story or a theme that, looking back, you wish had been given more attention or coverage both in Religion News Service and in the mainstream media as well?
Oh, I'll tell you one thing, that it's not actually a news story, because you wouldn't have news developments happening, but it's more of a feature story that I don't see enough. And I've certainly, toward the end of last year, I started encouraging my reporters to look more at this, was the immigrant communities that we have in the U.S., how their faith, they may be Christians or, you know, be part of the same religion as most of us here, but worship or practice in a very different way. So one thing we did at the end of last year was I had one of my reporters look at how different immigrant communities celebrate Christmas. Mm. And so we had a look at two communities. One is Nigerian Christians and the other was Brazilian Christians. And I thought it was a nice look, and it was a very different, obviously Christmas in Nigeria and Brazil are very different from Christmas in the U.S. I love the part about that normally Brazilians go to the beach on on Christmas, and my reporter found a community that was going skiing and on Christmas Day.
What do you expect the most important stories to be in 2017?
Well, I think one of the most important stories will be, and again, probably no surprise, the Trump administration, how it deals with religious minorities, and in particular, Muslims. I think it will also be very interesting, and something I think we can uniquely focus on is the religious views of Donald Trump and his cabinet members, and how that informs the way they attempt to govern this nation.
Mm-hmm.
I think another interesting thing to look at will be how evangelicals reconcile after such a divisive election. In particular, I'm curious about the Southern Baptists after someone like Russell Moore, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, mm-hmm. was so outspoken in his opposition to Donald Trump. And it appears, at least from the exit polls, that many Southern Baptists disagreed with him.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the year ahead.
Are you curious about how many in the evangelical community who endorsed totally the Trump campaign and Trump as the candidate to vote for, what's going to happen to them when they see what's going to be inevitably decisions and involvements that, at least in the past, would have been considered out of bounds for a morally responsible leader?
The unknown factor really is Donald Trump and how he will. I mean, I have no idea how he's going to govern. It's hard to tell from all his tweets what he plans to do. I have a better sense of what Vice President Mike Pence wants.
Yeah.
And I think he will be a very influential person in this White House. I think we will see a lot of conservative issues being brought to the fore. And, you know, to the extent that Donald Trump may end up being liberal economically or have some policies that liberals might agree with economically, I don't think we'll see too much of that in terms of social values. So one of my first questions right after the election to people like Ralph Reed of the Faith and Freedom Forum and others was, how can you count on a man who seems to have been on both sides of almost every issue to deliver what you want him to deliver? And certainly with the record that he has. But they seemed confident, and he has been giving them cabinet picks to their liking, for the most part, at least.
Yeah.
Drumpf, you've been in this position of leadership now for well over a year. What's been the biggest surprise for you since becoming editor-in-chief at RNS?
I've been running this organization for 1/80th of its history. So it has a venerable history, and there have been a few things. For me personally, I thought I would miss not having my own byline out. I imagine your listeners listen to public radio also. I've been on NPR and sure. Voice of America, and before that worked for the Associated Press. I don't miss not writing my own stories. It's a real challenge and a lot of fun to work with other reporters and getting them to write the best story that they can. One of the pleasant surprises, it's always nice to hear how many people know of RNS or have heard about it and really find what we do to be fascinating and something that you don't find elsewhere in the whole media landscape. And I think it's wonderful, Welton, that you're interested. And I know you've been involved in interfaith work and religious freedom work for a long time. And I think it's great that you're doing what you're doing and that can highlight what we do as well.
Well, thank you. Jerome Sokolowski is a veteran religions journalist and broadcaster who serves as editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, and you should visit religionnews.com on a regular basis. Jerome, thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio. I'm sure we're going to be in touch during this very interesting year.
Thank you very much, Welton, and all the best for a happy and prosperous 2017.
When the next president of the United States is inaugurated on January 20th, a who's who of political conservative Christianity will be at his side. How much of that is connected with the next vice president, a self-described evangelical Catholic? And how much does it tell us about the role organized religion is likely to play in a Trump administration? Here with some insights is Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, Happy New Year and welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. I'm always glad to be here.
So what was your first reaction to the announced list of religious leaders for the inauguration?
My first reaction, frankly, was that seeing Franklin Graham on that list did not give me confidence in the inclusiveness of the upcoming administration. I was distressed that all of the religious speakers seemed to be of a particular narrow swath of American Christianity, with the exception of Rabbi Heyer from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and that in and of itself was a surprise.
Mm-hmm. I saw a piece, and I think it was in the Washington Post, on why evangelicals ought to be disturbed by the people that have been selected to be at the leaders in the inauguration. It seems to me, Jack, that you go down that list and you picked Franklin Graham. I certainly would have picked him too right off. But it's almost as if, with the exception you just mentioned, every one of those people poses real problems because they never have shown much realization that there is a church-state separation in a country with religious freedom.
So I think that's correct. It's a troubling lineup. I do note that Rick Warren spoke at President Obama's inauguration in 2012, and he did an admirable job of being inclusive. But Rick Warren was one of any number of people who participated in the inaugural events. I myself was invited to be a part of the prayer service before the public inauguration, which was also a multivalenced opportunity for reflection and blessing. But I'm getting the impression that the nominees and the invitees and the people that have surrounded our president-elect have been sort of the answers to the question, who do I know? Rather than who's the right person and what will add credence and credibility to this endeavor that we're in together to reimagine the country. That's very distressing to me.
What message do the president-elect's choices for these responsibilities, what message does this send to Americans who are not members of chosen religion?
It certainly sends a message to me as a Jew that there's much room for me on that platform, or that if there is room for me, it is only in that very narrow strip of American Judaism that is Orthodox. I think that people who are mainline Protestants, I think Roman Catholics, I think that certainly anybody who is part of the many minority faiths, and people who affirm no faith at all, who either claim to be agnostic or atheist, are going to find themselves unrepresented at this seminal moment, this pivotal moment in American society. And it is particularly distressing, Welton, because we have spent the last 8 years, not without struggle, making great advances in the area of inclusiveness and pluralism in this country. Interfaith Alliance has both been in the forefront of those struggles and has celebrated those accomplishments. And now we're looking from the very first moment of the Trump presidency at an attempt to turn the clock back to a time when, as we all know, everyone in America was an evangelical Protestant.
Are there minority faith groups that have been speaking out about this?
Oh, I don't know a minority faith group that hasn't been speaking out about this, including the minorities within the evangelical Christian community, who are distressed that many of the values that they uphold as being appropriate for a righteous life seem to be fuzzy or less among some of the members of the incoming administration. So we have heard from Jews, from Muslims, from Sikhs, from Hindus, and especially from the community of secularists, that they're very distressed as to what seems to be ahead.
So for a moment, let's just assume the worst. Favored religious groups will get preferential treatment, and that treatment is likely to go way beyond what is constitutionally acceptable. What would the role of Interfaith Alliance be in that kind of scenario?
So I want to speak very, very small first, and then I will speak more philosophically, more largely. We have, you and I, Welton, a dear friend named Maggie Siddiqui, who works for, right now, the Al-Hibri Foundation. She is an American Muslim, born and raised here, covers her hair. She's very devout. She's also very progressive and has worked very hard at our coalitions. When the talk of a Muslim registry and the talk of excluding immigrants from countries that are majority Muslim or Arab was afoot in the campaign, she really had sort of a public panic, and she posted something about it on Facebook. I immediately picked up the phone and called her, and I reassured her. I said, Maggie, you have nothing to worry about. I will stand with you no matter what. And the people in my community, both the Jewish community and the interfaith community, will stand with you no matter what. Don't be afraid. We're all going to stand together. She was very appreciative of that phone call, I have to tell you. And she, in fact, recorded it off of her telephone so she could post it on Facebook as the response to her small panic attack. Mm. A few weeks later, there was a report that I'm sure most of our listeners saw of the gathering of white supremacists in Washington, D.C., where Richard Spencer was busy doing his best imitation of National Socialism in Weimar Germany. And seeing the salutes that were being offered to him and the cries of Hail Trump and things like that. And Maggie's Facebook posting that day was to her Jewish friends. And it said, I don't want you to worry about anything. I'm going to stand with you no matter what. And the people around me and the people in the organizations I'm involved with will stand with you also. That kind of person-to-person and direct support, mutual support among the communities that feel threatened is extraordinarily important. And it was something I was able to do because of the position I hold. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of outreach that we at Interfaith Alliance are going to encourage between neighbor and neighbor. That is something that anybody listening to this program can do, is to make sure that their neighbors know that no matter what their religious perspective, no matter what their philosophy, that their neighbors are going to stand with them in support of their constitutional rights. As an organization, I have to say that you left me a great legacy, Welton. Unfortunately, we fought a lot of these battles already 4 years ago, 12 years ago, 20 years ago. And we will continue to lobby our legislators. We will continue to join a coalition on legislation and to file amicus briefs on court cases that secure the hard-won rights of Americans of minority status and, frankly, majority status as well. There is not a mass conspiracy against Protestants in this country, but there are times when we in the interfaith community need to stand up for our Christian brothers and sisters who otherwise enjoy certain privilege.
Jack, in the first weeks after the election, we broadcast some interviews asking some of our favorite regular guests what their mindset was. Not surprisingly, there was a lot of worry and concern with faith leaders in particular sharing the fears they were hearing from congregants. And then we got some complaints with people saying we shouldn't be stressing the negative, but it would be beyond inauthentic to predetermine the tone of our interviews. Now that some weeks have passed, what are you hearing from members and supporters of Interfaith Alliance? Has the tone shifted at all?
The tone of concern, if anything, has gotten deeper as people have seen the nominees to the various positions of authority in the Trump administration. And I want to emphasize that's concern. There are some people who are attempting to organize a revolution against thin air right now. I'm not one of those people who thinks we should wait and see what's going to happen. We have to be prepared. But I'm also not one of those people who is ready to issue a symbolic call to arms, because we've heard some unpleasant things from the incoming president. I will tell you a great story, Welton, that I'm not telling out of school, because it will also be on social media today. I'm fortunate to have a friendship with Senator Tim Kaine, and saw him for the first time after the election just the other day. We were in a group of people having a conversation about his experiences, and he was asked what gave him hope. And he said when he got to his office, his staff showed him a picture that was posted on Facebook by a little girl in Richmond, which is his hometown. And it came with a letter that said she was concerned because she had any number of children in her class who were the children of immigrants, and she was worried that they were going to be deported. And she said, "You have to be the hero that will protect them." And she drew a picture, and the picture was of him, including his pin that he wears on his lapel to indicate he's a United States senator. And flowing from his back was a cape with a T on it. And she wrote to him, "Be the hero." And Senator Kaine was just so touched and tickled by that. And by today, when we're speaking, has posted on his Facebook an appreciation of that picture and a challenge to everyone who reads it, which is, we can all hashtag be the hero. And I think that is more a sense of what I'm getting from people, is that they are ready for the challenge of what's ahead. There is no turning back the clock to a different election outcome. It seems to be the will of at least the Electoral College. But moving forward, we can't simply wring our hands and furrow our brows and condemn what hasn't happened yet. We have to be prepared to defend our values and our commitments.
Oh, that's a great story and inspiring. I want to look up the street from you in Washington for a moment. You spectacularly work with a lot of leaders on Capitol Hill. Without naming names, can you talk about the tone you're hearing from the lawmakers with whom you're talking right now?
Sure. I will say that right after the election, the people that I have a relationship with were stunned and depressed. And I will say that, again, without naming names, they're not all Democrats. Mm-hmm. They were distressed because they objected before the election to the tone of the campaign, and particularly from Mr. Trump. But what I have heard post-election is the same kind of determination that was expressed by Senator Kaine. Everybody now, those who support the president-elect and those who are concerned about the president-elect, everybody now believes that there is a shift coming in American society, and that it is up to each of us to work as hard as we possibly can to make sure that the America ahead is better than the America that was behind. And I will leave it to individual listeners as to whether that means America will be yet greater or America will be great again. But everybody believes that America's great.
We're just about out of time, but I want to ask you two questions that I think merge with one another. As we start this new year, what should listeners be keeping in mind? And along with that question, what are the priorities, or what is the priority of Interfaith Alliance right now?
Great. So the first thing that listeners should keep in mind is not to give up. Never give up, never give in. That the support that they have shown for State of Belief Radio, that the support that they've shown for Interfaith Alliance, continue to be critical elements in the public discourse around protecting freedom of conscience and protecting the independence of government from religious influence and from influencing religion. So that is the mindset I urge people to cultivate. You want to be unhappy, you want to be depressed, or you want to be elated. That's all well and good. The hard work is ahead of us, and we shouldn't give up. Interfaith Alliance, I will say, is examining its priorities now. We really believed, and I don't apologize for this, that we would be looking at sanding some rough edges. And now it seems to me that we're going to be looking at the kind of agenda that we had in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, when we could not be assured that some of the rights and privileges that we had been fighting for would be secured. We made great strides over the past 8 years, and we're going to have to work hard to protect them.
Rabbi Jagmeline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for every American. Among its other important work, the Alliance has been the sponsor of this show since its inception. Jack, I don't have to tell you, it's going to be a challenging year. We'll keep listeners up to date on the work of Interfaith Alliance and ways for them to join in that work. For that reason and others, we want you more prominent on this show and talking about things that you want to be talking about that are important related to what's going on in our nation. Today, thanks for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on your support to be able to continue this important work, as we have since the launch of this show on January 15th, 2006. As we get ready for our 12th year of continuous broadcasting, we're counting on you now more than ever. And quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something today that you find to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing what you liked. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. You can also direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. So be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.